I want a new drug, one that won't spill, one that don't cost too much to come in a pill. A new drug, one that won't go away, it won't keep me up all night, don't make me sleep all day.
A few years ago, frustrated by the proliferation of pseudoscience in the mainstream media, physician Dr. Ben Goldacre took to the internet. He created www.badscience.net, a blog devoted to the debunking of pseudoscience, where readers are invited to send in their own examples and questions. Since then, he's become one of the UK's most famous physicians. His first book, Bad Science, has sold over 500,000 copies worldwide. His new book is Bad Pharma: How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Ben Goldacre to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What brought you to look especially at drug companies? Because I assume in your work when it came to pseudoscience that drug companies came up a lot.
That's right. In some respects, this is kind of the postgraduate version of quack busting. Quacks and big drug companies use exactly the same tricks to bamboozle their customers. But drug companies use slightly more sophisticated versions of those tricks. So I have to say, I'm mainly interested in this as a nerd, as somebody who's kind of, you know, I have a kind of grudging respect for the way that people can distort scientific evidence. But at the same time in medicine, we shouldn't shy away from the fact that this has very real-world consequences for patient care. But the other reason why I was really keen to write about it was there are so many lame criticisms that people make of the pharmaceutical industry. So commonly what you see are anti-vaccine conspiracy theories or people who say that Big Pharma's hiding the cure for cancer or suppressing the truth about their miracle vitamin pills. And really, I just wanted to put in one place a kind of coherent explanation of all of the well-documented shortcomings in the way that medicine operates that have been documented so extensively in the professional academic literature.
Well, one of the things that caught my attention right away, and just in the subtitle, is how drug companies mislead doctors. We've certainly heard a lot about the second part, which is harming patients. When it comes to the misleading, is that deliberate?
Well, I think it's almost senseless to try and decide if people are malevolent. All we can do is look at the overall outcome and performance of the system as a whole. Now, the most important problem, I think, that is identified in the book is that clinical trials can go missing in action. So a drug company or an independent academic researcher can do as many trials as they want and only publish the ones that they want to. And in general, that means that people are much more likely to publish flattering results. And that's not the result of any kind of cherry-picking. That's a well-documented finding in the medical academic literature, and a systematic review, the most current systematic review that's just 2 years old, looks at all of the dozens of studies that have ever been done on this, and it shows that overall, about half of all of the clinical trials for the treatments that we do use today haven't been published, and that on average, trials with positive results are about twice as likely to be published as trials with negative results. Now, this has huge implications for patient care because we use the results of clinical trials as doctors to make informed decisions about which treatment is best with our patients. And to be absolutely clear, I think it's actually fairly unusual that drugs come onto the market which do more harm than good. But I do think there are very serious questions about whether we have all of the evidence necessary to work out which treatment is best for a particular patient because so much information is withheld.
You make the point in the book, with that said, that we like to imagine that medicine is based on evidence and the result of testing that is fair and complete, but that in reality, you write, those tests are often profoundly flawed. So is the testing flawed, or is it the information that the doctors and the patients and even the governing organizations are provided with that is flawed or incomplete?
So there are flaws at every step in the system. And the thing that I think is particularly fascinating but also pernicious is that there's this huge interlocking ecosystem of problems and shortcomings that all reinforce each other. So we have an ongoing problem of clinical trials which are flawed by design. We like to imagine that trials are necessarily always a fair test of which treatment is best. But actually, you often see that clinical trials are conducted, for example, in ideal patients who are younger and healthier and much more likely to get better than the real-world population that we'll be making clinical decisions in. We see trials where people move the goalposts and switch the outcomes after the trial is finished, which means that they overstate and exaggerate benefits. But it's absolutely vital that we're clear here. I've written this book in order to prick the fantasy, which I think many, many doctors and policymakers and even academics have, that we practice evidence-based medicine. In reality, I think we've awarded ourselves that badge of honor a little bit too soon. There are still huge shortcomings in the way that we do things. We have flawed trials, we have missing trials, and then, of course, through marketing, we have biased dissemination of the evidence that we do manage to create.
I think one of the points that you make that is fascinating is that many of these problems in the system, many of these problems all along the way that you just outlined, are often shielded from the public and from scrutiny simply because they're very complex and very difficult to understand.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when I said this isn't a kind of conspiracy theory book, it's also not a self-help book, and I'm probably doing myself out of sales like massively here. But, you know, this isn't a book about how to get the best out of your doctor. This is a technical book describing how we measure the risks and benefits of treatments and what the shortcomings in our systems for those are. And I think, you know, in the medical and academic profession, there's been a lot of complacency and lack of ambition. People being satisfied that as long as people are running these $10 or $100 million trials, that as long as there's, you know, as long as there's food on the table, then we're happy with the way things are. And we fail to address these shortcomings. And I find that, as a reasonably young doctor, very frustrating. And I'm more angry with senior doctors and academics from my own profession than I am with drug companies, because I think it's doctors and academics who we should be able to feel entitled to have high expectations of. And so you're absolutely right. The reason I wrote this book was really to try and involve the public in fixing this stuff, because it came out a couple of months ago in the UK, and there's been an extraordinary response, actually. There's been a series of questions in Parliament. There's a UK Parliament Select Committee inquiry looking into the problem of half of all clinical trials going missing in action. But some of the response from senior figures in medicine and academia has been, you know, look, old chap, we were fixing this quietly behind closed doors. And actually, the reality is we've known about the problem of clinical trial results being withheld from doctors and patients for about three decades now, and we haven't fixed this behind closed doors. And we have to involve the public. I think we need the public's help to better understand these problems. And, you know, as long as the mainstream discourse about flaws in the pharmaceutical industry consists of infantile anti-vaccination conspiracy theories, then we're not going to move forward. We need the public to understand the true technical story of how, you know, the pills aren't killing us, but we haven't optimized care. We haven't put in place the systems that I think the public imagine that we would surely have to ensure that we pick the best treatments.
You write in a chapter on marketing that it is doctors who make the final decision about signing a prescription, but in reality, the decision of which treatment to choose and whether to bother with treatment at all is made between them and their patients. This is entirely how you would want things to be, but it does make patients another lever to be leaned on by an industry keen to increase sales, which makes the advertising of prescription drugs really something to look at when it comes to our understanding of the medicines that we take and what is available to us. And we have seen a proliferation over the last decade or two in the amount of advertising, especially on television in this country, that permeates almost every... I think it's almost impossible to spend an hour or two watching television and not have some level of pharmaceutical advertising come across our screen. So how big a part of a problem do you see that being?
Well, first of all, it's important to be clear that adverts work. So there's very clear evidence in the academic literature that when you have adverts for a particular medicine, patients are more likely to ask for it, doctors are more likely to prescribe it. And there's also some concerning evidence showing that doctors are more likely to prescribe inappropriately because their patient has requested an inappropriate prescription. So, for example, when people request antidepressant medication, when the clinical circumstance doesn't really suggest that it would be of any use. So adverts work, and I think that's troubling because in medicine, you know, there is a right answer about which treatment is best. It's not like which pair of trousers or what record you want to buy. There is an answer, and I find it actually, just taking a step back from marketing, peculiar that we've underinvested so much in medicine on better systems and infrastructure for gathering the evidence that we already have and putting it into practice. So we spent hundreds of millions of dollars on doing clinical trials, sometimes hundreds of millions on just one clinical trial. But we don't spend anything like that much money on gathering the evidence together and making sure that we put the evidence that we already have into practice. So the whole system of medicine is already vulnerable to distortion by the biased dissemination of information that you see in marketing, because marketing, in some respects, is kind of the only game in town. All of that said, I actually think that the strangest thing about direct-to-consumer advertising, the drug adverts that you have on television here, which, by the way, to somebody from the UK where we don't have those adverts, they look completely bizarre and strange. I think overall, actually, it does the industry more harm than good. I don't think they're very stylish. I think they contribute to the sense of suspicion that people have about industry. I think also the very long lists of side effects, which of course you have to have at the end of an advert. I think also, you know, it costs, I'm sure, the industry more in overall credibility than they gain. And actually, this is a really sort of core feature of the book, because I'm not anti-industry, and I'm certainly not anti-drugs. I mean, you know, there is no medicine without medicines. And, you know, we need pharmaceutical companies to produce these fantastic new products. We just need them to behave a bit better than they do, publish all the research that they do, and maybe step back from biased dissemination of evidence. I find it extraordinary that industry is so resistant to the kinds of suggestions that I make in this book. Like, you know, when I say I think industry should share the full clinical study reports of all of the trials that they do, I get lurid and colorful denunciations from Pharma, the US pharmaceutical industry trade body. But actually, people should be able to make plenty of money out of transparently sharing the information on how well a drug works and from doctors and patients using the treatments that work best. And similarly, you know, I actually think industry shoots itself in the foot by advertising drugs on television. I think it looks seedy. And it's remarkable, really, to think that the pharmaceutical industry, which makes these life-saving products, which should have one of the best reputations in the whole of the sphere of corporate industries, it's extraordinary that they have almost the worst reputation. I mean, they're down there with bankers, and yet they produce life-saving products. And it's because they throw it away at the final furlong of the race by hiding data and engaging in these seedy marketing practices. And it's very, very peculiar. I don't think that they're acting in their own best interests. And I think that the organizations like Pharma, the U.S. pharmaceutical industry body, do the many ethical professionals who work in the pharmaceutical industry a great disservice. You know, I know people who work in Pharma, and they don't want to operate in systems where there are perverse incentives that result in doctors and patients being misled. That's not what they went into the industry for. And I think, you know, there's a real failure of leadership at the moment in the pharmaceutical industry. I don't think they reflect the interests of doctors and patients as well as they should. But actually, I don't think they reflect the interests of the people who work in that industry.
Ben Goldacre is the author of the book Bad Pharma, How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. When you talk about them shooting themselves in the foot, it does not seem to be shooting themselves in the foot financially.
Well, we don't know what the outside option would be, actually. So Pharma, the U.S. Pharmaceutical industry body, said when I called for drug companies to release all clinical trial results in the New York Times 2 weeks ago, they said in a press release the next day that this would kill innovation. Now, firstly, there's absolutely no, I mean, I don't understand what the logical structure of that is supposed to be, because it should be perfectly possible for drug companies to become filthy rich off selling the best drug in its class. And if you have to obfuscate on the evidence, if you have to hide evidence in order to make money out of a drug, well, it's not a drug worth selling. And actually, if you made a lot of money out of the best drug in its class and you couldn't make so much money out of the third best drug in its class, then actually I think that would sharpen the incentives for innovation overall. So I don't think that there is a trade-off here between ethical behavior and making money. But secondly, GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, one of the biggest drug companies in the world, with a terrible track record. They paid a fine of $3 billion last year for acts of criminal and civil fraud, including withholding information on clinical trials. GSK have just signed up to alltrials.net, which is a campaign that I helped start in the UK, calling on drug companies to share all the results of their clinical trials with doctors and patients. And GSK have signed up, and they're going to share full clinical study reports going back to the beginning of the company. So this is all of the clinical trials that GSK have ever done. Now, I think this is really interesting because, firstly, it shows pharma are completely wrong to claim that this is an impossible ask. It shows that it's actually perfectly possible for a drug company to share all of the results of all of their clinical studies. Now, there's also a second round issue. As soon as GSK starts sharing all of their information, and I hope that other companies will be signing up too, then doctors and health insurers are suddenly in a very interesting situation. Because let's say there are two drugs, and they both have apparently equal benefits, but one of them is made by a company where you know that they share all of their information, and the other is made by a company who has refused to sign up to a pledge committing to share everything. Now, we know that overall, under the current system, about half of all the clinical trials for the drugs we use don't get published, haven't been published, and also we know that trials with positive results are about twice as likely to get published. So if you've got a choice between two drugs where they both seem to be equivalently beneficial, but one of them you know you've got all the evidence and the other you don't know if that company's still withholding half of the evidence, then I think doctors and insurers and patients would probably want to choose the one that's made by the company that has made a pledge to be transparent. So actually, I think that now that GSK have made a first commitment to share all clinical trial results, that is a really interesting step up in the game, because I think we could start to see a world in a couple of years when drug companies are delivering on this promise. We could start to see a world where actually people think, I'm not sure it's safe to use a treatment where maybe a third or a half of the evidence is being withheld. I think I'm going to only use the drugs that are made by the company that has made a promise of transparency. And that, I think, opens up a really interesting new game, because the real problem right now is the lack of financial rewards for ethical behavior in the pharmaceutical industry.
As we wrap up, just give us an example that would illustrate why having this information is so important, in the sense of, If there is full transparency and we know all about the trials and we have all of this information, does that give us an increased sense of skepticism and questioning perhaps that is necessary for a drug? Or does it slow down progress because we feel that we have to do then more testing and more tweaking?
Well, the thing that makes us do more testing is having half of the results of the clinical trials that have been conducted at great expense withheld from us. And actually, also, let's remember, real-world patients participate in clinical trials, and people participate in clinical trials in the belief that they're doing something to help society. They're doing something to improve our knowledge and understanding of medicine and improve treatment decisions for other patients like them in the future.
So what are they hiding, is the more essential question.
It's often unflattering information about the efficacy of a drug that's being withheld. We know that half of all trials don't get published for the treatments that we use today, and we know that trials with positive results are about twice as likely to be published. A concrete example, I guess, that's topical right now, since it's winter and it's flu season, is a drug called Tamiflu that's made by a company called Roche.
Right.
Now, governments around the world have spent billions of dollars on stockpiling this drug. And yet, when the Cochrane Collaboration, which is an international non-profit academic body that produces gold standard summaries of all of the research that's ever been done on any clinical question in medicine, and then that's widely used, it's sort of widely regarded as the gold standard in medicine for which treatment works best. It's an organization of 14,000 academics worldwide. When the Cochrane Collaboration asked Roche for the full clinical study reports on Tamiflu, because they knew that several of the trials hadn't been published, when they asked for the full clinical study reports, which is where you can find out about the real gnarly details about what was done exactly in a trial, which you need to be sure that it was a fair test of the treatment, when they asked Roche for those, Roche refused to hand them over. And not only that, but Roche then, oddly enough, promised that they would share them in December 2009, and they still, 3 years later, haven't done so. Now, there is extensive review of this right now in the UK. Several of the researchers who are working on Tamiflu are now beginning to speculate that maybe Tamiflu is actually no better than aspirin. But the reality is, if we don't have access to all of that information, we can't know what the effects of the treatments are. So it may be that Tamiflu is a reasonably effective drug. It may be that it's no better than aspirin. But to make an informed judgment about that, everybody has to have access to all of the information about the clinical trials. Science, if it has any authority, that authority is built on transparency. We don't take things on trust in science. In science, we believe what you say because you show us you're working. You show us exactly what you did, exactly how you conducted your experiment, exactly what evidence you collected, exactly what the results were. And then we can have a serious conversation about the strengths and the weaknesses of your research and whether we really think that the conclusions that you draw are justified and enough for us to use that information in making treatment decisions. So what we see in Tamiflu is a situation where many doctors and academics now feel very uncertain about the benefits of this treatment. And the opportunity to reassure us by moving towards full transparency has been declined. So that's a drug which we spent billions of dollars on. And, you know, you don't want to throw billions of dollars away in your healthcare system unless you're absolutely certain that you can trust that the results are good.
The name of the book, Bad Pharma, How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. It's published by Faber and Faber. Dr. Ben Goldacre, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us and sharing your findings with us. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Bad Pharma. It is published by Faber and Faber. Ben Goldacre is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.